listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. This week,
Peace Talk with the Tundra Women's Coalition.
Good morning, everyone. This is Taylor Finley. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday. I'm the Youth Services Manager at TWC here in Bethel. This morning, I'm joined by Scotty. Scotty, would you introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Scotty. I'm one of the JVs in town working, serving at the thrift store. So I handle the thrift store mainly. But
yeah, amazing. We love our thrift store. If you've never been, you can follow us on Facebook. What's our Facebook again, Scotty?
TWC Thrift.
And I think it's super cool to have an accessible place where people can get basic needs and like cool, fun stuff for an affordable price. It's one of the only places in Bethel where anything is affordable. And the connection to sort of our violence prevention work, we're on Wellness Wednesday where we talk about violence prevention. It's our bread and butter. So violence prevention wise, it's such a phenomenal resource being right next to our shelter, where folks utilizing shelter can either get a voucher for clothing or for household goods as they're moving from shelter into their own homes, or they can volunteer at the thrift store to gain some work experience. I think as far as like a violence prevention angle, our thrift store, I can't believe I haven't talked about it before. You might have to come back, Scotty. Our thrift store is a really awesome sort of approach that TWC takes to do things good for the community and also empower and assist people who have survived violence and are utilizing our services.
For sure. Yeah, those vouchers are amazing. I'll have parents come in with a $25 voucher. And they'll have like three baby shirts and a pair of baby shoes. And I'm like, you have 10 more dollars to spend. Like, you can rack it up. And
I'm sure they literally cannot believe that.
Yeah, they're just shocked. Like, oh, and then they just run around. And I'm like, yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, awesome work over there. We're so thankful for our JV community and all the work that you all the service you all do at TWC, the pedantic language. We love JVC Northwest. And TWC, we've had Jesuit volunteers for just decades and decades now, and a lot of the stuff that we do specifically with TAV, one of my programs, like it just couldn't happen with you all. So awesome.
Yeah, JVC's great. I'm really lucky to be here. I'm excited. My cat's definitely missing me back home, but I'm doing good work here, so I'm excited.
Boy, what was I going to say next? You threw me off thinking about cats. Mine was like screaming at me this morning, so I didn't get to sleep in all the way. So I'm like trying to recombobulate. So we're in April already. How did April happen in 2026? Oh my goodness. So looking at our violence prevention sort of calendar of events, we celebrate two really important months. We reflect and remember in the month of April, both people who have experienced child abuse and talk about child abuse prevention. And also it is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. So in both of these contexts, you know, TWC's job is to use this month to uplift the voices of survivors of those experiences, both child abuse and sexual assault survivors, and also be advocates and educators. It's our job to get information out there, and a remembrance or a celebration or an awareness month is a really great tool for us. You know, we're able to come on the radio show or use our social media platforms to be able to just boost some facts and help people understand a little bit more about topics that are really difficult. So I'll sort of start a little bit about Child Abuse Prevention Month. So again, that's April. That is usually indicated, you know, you have your ribbons for your awareness month, and our child abuse prevention ribbon is blue. We started off the month kind of like we did for teen dating violence awareness month. In February, we wore orange. In April, for Child Abuse Prevention Month, we wore blue. I had a whole day where all of the TWC staff, you know, just showed that solidarity, wore that blue, and, you know, stood against sexualized violence and stood with people who have experienced that. Later this month, on the 24th, We're having a joint walk for both of these months where we as TWC are meeting at, I believe we're doing the Cultural Center to TWC, but yeah, but you'll be able to find out more information at our event on Facebook. We'll post on our TWC Facebook and our Teens Acting Against Violence Facebook, where you as a community member can join us and uplift the violence prevention efforts in our community by attending our joint Child Abuse Prevention and Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we wrap up later in the hour, but Scotty is working on a really awesome project for Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month that he will talk about here in a little bit. Like we do on Wellness Wednesdays on Peace Talks, I figured we'd start with just a little bit of information. So I'll talk a little bit about child abuse prevention. Child abuse prevention is one of those topics that's difficult to talk about. We have our Children's Advocacy Center at TWC, and that Children's Advocacy Center is where we have a multidisciplinary team. That means that advocates at TWC and forensic interviewers, law enforcement, medical, sometimes OCS, and sometimes legal, like defense, district attorney, things like that, all work together when there is an allegation of child abuse. So child abuse can include a vast array of experiences a child can go through. Child abuse is any person under 18 years old, so a minor legally. And child abuse includes abuse, physical abuse, it includes sexual abuse of any kind, and then it also includes neglect or maltreatment. So the things that can be experienced in like sort of the child abuse umbrella can range really, really far. And it's kind of difficult to pinpoint what child abuse can always look like. So I think it's important as a violence prevention measure for us as community members to sort of have an idea of how you can spot child abuse and what you can do as someone who might, you know, observe that in your community or know a child that seems like they might be struggling. What's our role as community members? What should we look out for and what can we do to help in those situations? So at TWC, the first thing that we do as employees, even in our initial training, is go through mandatory reporting training through the state. In the state of Alaska, any person that works with children is required to go through this kind of training. So that's teachers, advocates like at TWC, it's pretty much anyone who works at a place that receives state or federal money. This is a training that you have to take. So when you take mandated reporter training or mandatory reporter training, you learn sort of about the differences of those three categories of child abuse. That's again, like intentional physical abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect and maltreatment. And really, what's the most important thing to know is that sometimes the signs aren't always super obvious. You know, if you're a person who is around children a lot, it's really about picking up on certain behaviors or noticing changes in children over time. One thing that, you know, I feel like people would be like, if you see large bruises on a child, absolutely, you know, physical injuries and physical evidence of abuse, paying attention, seeing if a child is unwell, feeling sick, having trouble walking, you know, and just paying attention and remembering that as a mandatory reporter or someone who wants to help and support a child, that our job is not as an investigator, it's as an observer. Our job is to notice signs and to tell the experts what we are noticing. If a person in community or if we at TWC, you know, work with a young person and think they might be experiencing violence, it is not our job to confront their parents. It is not our job to say, you know, seems like those bruises might have come from a weird place. Like, it's our job to ensure the like current safety and to make sure that we follow the proper channels of reporting that abuse. So looking at that physical violence, noticing physical signs, but then also something really important to remember is that the change in a child over time or sort of the experience of child abuse can change behavior in some noticeable ways as well. Children who socially withdraw, you know, if a child is very like chatty and happy and then sort of without reason or warning, no changes in the environment that you interact with the child in, they grow distant from friends or they like use shorter words in responding, like they are less communicative, they withdraw, they're more quiet, that can be an indicator and could, you know, merit paying a little closer attention. And then the other behavioral sign that I think is pretty important to pay attention to is that if children are using language that seems inappropriate, like if a small child knows a lot of words for their body parts that are not matching their stage in development. So if a 2 or 3 year old is, you know, using anatomical words, that can be really normal and healthy because it's important to be able to know and name your body parts. But other more colloquialized, I don't know what I can say on the radio, so I'm not going to give any examples, but you can imagine what I'm talking about. If a child really that is under 18 at all, but we're mostly looking at like elementary or earlier ages, if they're using words that adults use colloquially mm-hmm. for their body parts, usually that's meaning they're hearing it from somewhere, having sort of inappropriate knowledge or reference to sexualized topics. So if children are using those words or if they are behaving in a developmentally like inappropriate way to other children, we call that problematic sexual behavior in youth. That problematic sexual behavior in youth, there's a lot of things going on with children in their physiological development, in their brain development, that different stages, so between adolescence into puberty and from puberty into sort of that like second hormonal change from, we're looking sort of at like 0 to 4 and then from like 4 to 8 and then between 8 and 12, there's just so many developmental milestones happening. So as mandated reporters and for people who are looking out for signs of child abuse, you know, it's important to know that things like problematic sexual behavior in youth aren't like intrinsically linked to something like child abuse, but we know that there's something to pay attention to if there is like child on child sexual contact happening, or if there's like that inappropriate use of language happening. Those are signs that we as mandated reporters want to pay attention to. Pardon me. Got a cat here stuck in my throat. My cat Bean has like a really long fur and it's just covering my black shirt and keeps getting in my mouth. You're welcome for the information on the radio. Anyway, so when we're reporting as mandated reporters, those are the kinds of signs we're looking out for. And again, I think it's really important to sort of drive home that we are not investigators. We are not responsible for speaking to children about things that we might observe, because that can be dangerous, it can be triggering, and it's not something that people without the proper training should be inserting themselves in, because it's a very nuanced, difficult, complicated thing to get more information without causing as much disruption, protecting children without, you know, ruining the relationship between service providers and parents. Like, we don't want to sever trust between parent or child, and we want to make sure that children are safe. So threading the needle, following the process, being aware of these signs, and knowing that your job is to notice and to tell the Office of Children's Services. There is a long, complicated history in the region with children's services, and that is one of the reasons why child abuse goes so underreported, because there is a historical pattern of Alaska Native children being taken away from their families at massively disproportionate rates. And so remembering that there is no trust in that relationship, completely understandably so, makes it even more important to make sure the process is being followed now so that proper intervention, proper investigation can begin to look different over time. You know, if we as members of the community are reporting things that we know to be violent and then holding the offices in power accountable as well, paying attention to outcomes, you know, policy changes, paying attention to make sure that, like, child abuse prevention, you know, that continued abuse isn't happening through the system. It's a little convoluted, but it is important to recognize and understand that there's a reason, a really powerful, good reason that engagement with the system that exists feels uncomfortable, can feel unsafe. But the best way to, you know, combat child abuse is to know those signs and talk about those signs openly. Child abuse, specifically child sexual abuse, is so, it's a horrible, horrible thing, right? And so people don't want to talk about it. People don't want to bring it up. People don't want to, you know, speak vocally about things that have happened to them as a child or things that are happening. You know, like, it's just painful. It's uncomfortable. And, you know, it's not engaging radio content, for example. So being people who do know what child abuse is, who can speak openly about it, who can call it out when they see it, and can report through those proper channels are some of the best tools we have, and can learn more about during Child Abuse Prevention Month, to use throughout the year and all the time. So I have gabbed and gabbed about child abuse prevention. If you have any questions, you can, of course, always contact us at TWC. As the Youth Services Manager, I have tons of resources and access to all kinds of information, and would be happy to share that with anyone who is interested. I'll sort of shift over now to looking at Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And Scotty has done a lot of research about what sexual assault history and sort of like legislation experience of people within our region and within our state. Scotty, do you want to talk to us a little bit about Sexual Assault Prevention Month?
So Sexual Assault Awareness Month is this month. I found out that it was also Child Abuse Awareness Month, and I at first was like, oof, this is a tough month. Mm-hmm. This is, and I kind of wanted to be like, gee, like, how do we talk about both? But I think it's important to talk about both. I learned this stat in high school about it hurt people, obviously. So most people that abuse a child experience child abuse. And I think when you touched on the boarding schools and like the state taking kids in this region, that's a big sign of that happened when they were kids. And so they're just repeating the cycle. And I think our job now is to look back and realize what it is and try and stop that cycle. Mm-hmm. And so I'm here today to talk about sexual assault awareness. So basically, my school did a big thing for Denim Day where you wear denim on the last Wednesday of April. Denim Day, so that's what this month has been doing a lot for the thrift store. We've been talking a lot about it. If you follow our Facebook, if you don't, you totally should check us out, TWC Thrift. And we have been discussing just statistics, mainly 1 in 4 women have experienced sexual assault. 1 in 6 men have experienced sexual assault. It's not just like a woman issue. It's also a man issue. It's a human issue. I think, you know, it is important to notice that like 57% of women in the YK Delta have experienced sexual assault, which is a very large number. I think it's something like 8% of phone calls annually are for sexual assault, but which sounds bad. But if you think about it, like, typically, you might not confess to that right away. You might just say, he hit me or something, or mm-hmm. she hit me. So a lot of the other calls are just domestic abuse, but under that could be sexual assault that you're not really talking about. I think silence is really big, especially in very close communities where you don't want to hurt somebody. You don't want to talk about it. So you're going to keep it silent and just say, like, yeah, they were mean to me, and not really say what that was.
Absolutely. If I can share something I learned recently about TWC. So we're grant funded. And so certain grants, we have to collect certain information to report back to funders. Relatively recently, we got a grant that was for sexual assault survivors for support, for services. And so if you use this money, you could only work with survivors of sexual violence, not support survivors of domestic violence. In order to use that money, we then have to ask everyone, you know, what is your experience with sexual violence? And at whatever point that was in the shelter, you know, all but one or two people were there for domestic violence. But when our advocates went in and sort of talked with every person staying in shelter and talked, explained exactly what sexual violence meant, what sexual assault is, every single person that was staying in our shelter, even though they initially reported being there for domestic violence, had experienced sexual violence in their life. Every single one of them. So it's exactly like you were saying, something that is either misunderstood, difficult to talk about, or so normalized in the region that it's not even like first thought. You know, it's just something that happens so pervasively that people are like, oh, I'm in this physical pain. My arm is hurt. And that is what people care about. That's what we'll get paid attention to, and just sort of brush off and pass off the sexual violence they've experienced, sometimes like in a pattern over time for many, many years. So, yeah, so important to mention and to talk about how it is not something that is normal. So thank you for sharing more information. Let's learn some more.
Totally. Yeah. Also, child abuse awareness month is blue. Mm-hmm. Ours is teal. If you want to wear, denim or teal, I wore blue and I was the one to take the photo. So my blue was not appreciated.
That's, I forgot to wear blue, but they made me be in the photo anyway. I was like, oh no, we should have switched. Sorry about that.
It's all good. I'm not too bitter. But yeah, so Denim Day came about in 1998. There was an Italian judge who ruled in favor of a 45-year-old man over a 18-year-old girl because he was saying that her jeans were too tight and she had to have given consent because there's no way she would have taken them off, or he could have taken them off. But she had third-degree burns on the inside of her thighs, which is a little graphic. But it just shows that, like, obviously it was not consensual, and blaming it on jeans is just ridiculous. So in 1999, Denim Day launched at the last Wednesday in April. I don't know if the court case was in April. But yeah, pretty much a year later, it just caught on a lot very quick. And yeah, it's just a big issue. I think it's hard to trust a system where it's, why should I come forward if a judge is just going to rule in favor of my other person? But I think that's understandable. But if you also remember, another way to do it is just combat it at a community level, and like just as a neighbor, be like, I don't like this and I don't want it to happen to you. And so I'm going to like help stand up and like amplify your voice. And hopefully the more people we have together, the more people know that it's wrong, they won't do it. Because also if it happens to you at 8 and then it just continues to happen to you, and then by the time you're 18 or 19 and you have a younger cousin and you're just like, oh, this is just normal. And it's not normal. It's sad. So yeah, just ending that cycle and talking about it. So what we're doing at the thrift, we get a lot of jeans donated in various conditions, and sometimes their conditions aren't as ideal to sell or get rid of for free. So we just chop them up into 5x5 squares, and we have handed some out at the thrift store, and then we were also handing some out at the library until April 15th, which by the time this comes out, I think will have already passed. But we'll take those squares and put them together, and we're going to make a very cool quilt. True quilters will say it's not a quilt. We're sewing on to something. But it's essentially a quilt in a way. So super excited for that. I've never sewn before, so it'll be fun to learn how to use a sewing machine. But yeah, it's a huge issue. I think my idea with this quilt is just to get the community to come together and design one square or two squares and just put your feet, like your thoughts, and just kind of stand in solidarity with the victims or share and like, it's happened to me, it shouldn't happen to you, I don't want it to happen ever again. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think just this quilt, it won't pass any legislation, but I think it'll be a good opportunity for the community to come together. We'll be showing this quilt at the college campus in room 118, I believe, at 6 p.m. on April 29th, which is a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. There should be pizza there, so that'll be exciting. Come for solidarity, enjoy the pizza, admire our art. I've designed 3 to 8 squares, and I have very bad artistic skills, but there are other squares that are very pretty that I'm excited for people to be like, whoa.
We took a couple days during TAV, Teens Acting Against Violence. Our TAV youth are so incredibly artistic and really engaged in this sort of like social messaging and projects, and they've got some really awesome squares. I'm excited to see how Scotty brings them to life in the quilt.
I know. I'm excited for the TAV squares. I think they're going to be really cool. This TWC staff, last week, I believe, they designed some squares too, and we have some real artists at TWC, which I don't know.
This is not what we do every day.
We don't do art, but when you're so good at one thing, you know, really good at like talking mm-hmm. and like being a great safe space, and then also side skill, you're a great artist. That's unfair, but
right?
Also completely fair.
Can you remind me, where do we pick up the squares if you want to contribute to this project?
Yeah, so by the time this comes out, I believe, because we'll start sewing on the 18th, and I think this comes out the 23rd.
Oh, my bad.
It's all good. But if you do, I honestly think it would be kind of cool if you want to design your own 5x5 square and then just bring it on the 29th, we can safety pin that on. Like,
absolutely.
That would be cool. But yeah, so it's just 5x5 denim. If you have a time machine, you can come by and pick it up at the thrift store or the cultural center at the library. I believe we're actually the thrift store between TWC staff, the JVs, and TAV, and then customers that have picked up squares. We're out, so I might pick up some more today at the library, but we'll see. But yeah, so they are selling like hot, or they're free, but they're going like hotcakes, and so... Yeah, I'm excited. It should be really cool. Looking forward to it.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and when we're looking at violence prevention, when we're looking at community care and support, projects like this that really uplift voices, there's lots of sort of styles of these activities. We've got Denim Day that is sort of it's an act of resistance over this like horrific court case that said consent is implied by what you're wearing. It's this ridiculous concept that we see perpetuated in media. We see it perpetuated in like common vernacular, like these ridiculous, horrific things that we can look at, you know, sitting on the radio talking about and say, wow, how messed up is that? Like, that should never happen. But what we see day in and day out is that rhetoric, that sort of like understanding is confirmed, is repeated, is validated in all kinds of spaces. It's sort of elevating more and more. Like, sexualized violence is something that we just like see all the time. It's pervasive in the types of jokes that we hear and the types of like comments that are made about specifically women's bodies. And an advocacy project like Denim Day or a march like a Take Back the Night or a Slut Walk, all of these long standing since like the women's liberation movement, we're looking like 70s, these things that people have been raging against, screaming, making noise, calling it out, you know, continuing to uplift those voices, to use our own, to join in that fight and pressing against. On this show, we talk all the time about social norms and about how social norms inform how people act every day. It informs who we vote for in the polls. It informs what policies feel normal to people and what laws go into effect, how we talk every day, what we see on TV, that social norm, the impact of having normalization of sexualized violence like penetrates into everyone's understanding of themselves, of culture, of society, and taking an opportunity like Denim Day to break that off, to loudly say and create together, having this positive message that upsets those norms that say violence is something that is normal, it's so powerful. You know, you said that we're not changing any policies, but like we see time and time again that collective effort is what, you know, ripple effects change in community. It's what gets people educated. It's what gets people impassioned and emboldened, and what creates leadership and change and shifts in those norms over time. I say it every month, but flexing your say something muscles, speaking up, learning something new, engaging in a project like this is the best power that we have to combat things like sexual violence.
Yeah, I think
pardon me, sorry.
You're all good. I couldn't agree more. I think, yeah, the best way to come and combat it is just to come together as a community and just be like, I don't know, just something, this is going to be the cringy like JV in me, but like that, like care for your fellow person and just be like, I love you and I don't want this to continue to happen anymore. And just really approaching it from a world, like a viewpoint of just like, you want to help others is just so huge. And what it's just really important to not shame people for what they're wearing and or just people for who they are. I think you see it a lot with like in like the LGBTQ community, you see a lot of like mm-hmm. shaming or like it's reported less or cared about less. Like if I was like star quarterback gets assaulted, you'd be like, whoa. But then if it was like theater kid, you'd be mm-hmm. like, oh, well, like that happened. It's just not, it's bad, you know?
And absolutely.
It shouldn't matter. Someone had a really good, where it was like, this is someone's daughter or someone's mom. And then they crossed out all of it. And it was like, it's someone. Yeah. At the mm-hmm. end of the day, it's just somebody that's getting assaulted and that shouldn't happen.
Yeah, you're like validation as a human being isn't dependent on your relationship to another person.
For
that
sure.
Like individualism, that like right to existence, the power that every person has, I think is something really important to lift up. That messaging of like, she's someone's blah, blah, blah. I'm like, ew, gross. True, and our connections to others is what makes community and what, you know, is so beautiful about being human. But like sort of undercutting a person's individuality makes it easier to sort of like have them remain faceless. And so like, I appreciate you bringing that up, empowering the self of yeah. I am someone, I'm not someone's child. I'm not someone, it's like, I am important of my own right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You saw it a lot with like in the civil rights movement, I am a man, which is not really the same thing here, but mm-hmm. like it is important to acknowledge your importance as an individual and you have the ability to say no. And when you say no, that no should be fully accepted mm-hmm. and not ignored. But yeah, I think also just coming, I do also think like, I think isolationism has like a moment, but also I do think we need to be stronger as a community. And I think that this is what this quilt is doing. But yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think that, yeah. But yeah, I think community is important too, but also you are an individual and that's also important.
For sure. And I think you touched on something else that was really important, talking about how your sort of identities, who you are, what you've experienced sort of can impact the rate at which you are likely to experience violence. Last month, we talked a lot about, it was Women's History Month. So we did sort of like a breakdown over that women's rights movement since the beginning of the United States. And that led us to looking at intersectionality. To remind everyone, intersectionality is sort of that notion that we'll use our sexual assault prevention month sort of as an umbrella. So everyone can experience sexual assault. It is not a gendered issue. It is not a racial issue. It is something that can happen to anyone. When you dive into those statistics a little more, you do see that people who identify as female are experiencing sexual assault more. So that's an intersection within people who experience sexual assault, that intersection of being a person in society and your gender. So you've got one intersection there. If you dive even deeper into those statistics, that word, dive deeper into those statistics, you can see that it is statistically more likely that if you are Black or African American, the likelihood that you experience sexual assault in the United States is higher. Diving deeper into that statistic, we see that if you are at both intersections, if you are Black or African American and identify as female, the likelihood increases even further. So we're seeing that of these identity groups or demographics that we as individuals, all that comprises our identity, can inform our experience. And because of the way society is structured and how marginalized groups, you know, receive less care from society in general, the likelihood that these types of violences occur increase sort of, unfortunately, almost exponentially, depending on how many of these marginalized intersections you fall at. You specifically mentioned queer, LGBTQIA2S+ people, and that is another intersection that has just exponentially higher rates of sexual violence and significantly lower rates of reporting. We look at things like social stigma. We look at things like history of violence from powerful institutions. This goes for, you know, every intersection has these types of experience. They just sort of are in a different font depending on what time period they sort of originated in, or where we are in the history of moving forward to be more inclusive of that identity. But queer folks are one of the lowest groups to report sexualized violence or domestic violence, looking at those statistics as well, because there is sort of this like internalized homophobia within society and within the systems that are there to support and assist people. It's great that we got around to this topic because we actually have a campaign at TWC. We have a specific stream of funding that is for queer folks to receive specialized advocacy at TWC. We recognize, of course, that sexual assault is not a gendered issue, is not a queer or not issue, that it can happen to everyone. So we have messaging around town and on our socials that say Tundra Everyone's Coalition. It's in rainbow lettering and really supports the fact that at TWC, right here in Bethel, anyone in the region who falls within the LGBT community or whose gender does not align with what maybe society understands a survivor of violence looks like. We have advocates who are specifically trained to support people of those intersections and identities, because we recognize, again, with that sort of stigmatization, with the historical context of being queer and engaging with law enforcement, we recognize that our advocates need to be empowered to stand up and to push back if there is any sort of victim blaming surrounding that identity, any kind of misunderstanding surrounding medical care, which can look different for members of the queer community. I have here a little flyer of just what advocacy can look like. And I think it's really cool to look at in this queer-specific context, looking at supporting people who have different needs than perhaps people in that majority population. So helping someone call a shelter or advocacy program. Sometimes when you're a person of a marginalized group, I can speak as a queer person myself, sort of asking for support around what I need can feel like coming out over and over again. It can feel like I'm inviting criticism, or like just giving someone the opportunity to treat me poorly. And so it's difficult sometimes to be the person that decides to engage in a service. When you walk in the door, there's a giant question mark of if they will let you in, if they will call you your name, if they will listen to what's affecting you. And having someone there with you, like having a safe support person, having an advocate, can be all of the difference. It can be the difference in reporting a sexual assault or not, receiving medical services or not, telling law enforcement what has happened to you or not. Having someone who's there for you, who listens and validates and understands, is like one of the most powerful tools. Helping calling the police or calling the doctor. There's so many, like, when someone experiences something like sexual assault, there's just, like, so many things that need to happen, right? And we'll move away sort of from looking at queer-specific stuff, because this applies to everyone in that after that moment, that deeply, like, traumatizing experience, it then sort of becomes your responsibility as the survivor to then engage with all of these systems. And as an advocate, not just like a that's what my paycheck says advocate like me at TWC, but anyone in community can be an advocate by helping people look for services like this, helping people call police, getting lunch for someone, helping watch someone's kid, you know, picking up a shift for someone if they can't come into work. Like, there's so many ways that we in community can be advocates and care for one another in response to things like sexual assault and sexual violence. I think what this graphic says, that every act of support counts, that supporting someone can look a lot of different ways. Support can be listening. Support can be just believing, validating. Support can be giving someone a ride, helping them to the grocery store. Like, when we're being supporters and advocates, it's not our job to solve someone's problem. It's not our job, again, to investigate or make things better. It's our job to be there. It's our job to listen, and in understanding that nothing is too small, nothing is like, I don't know, just having connection to normalcy, to community, to people, for someone who is in that state of trauma, who's experienced that kind of violence, can make all the difference in making them feel able to move forward, which is a really powerful tool that we have in our sort of advocacy tool belt, I think.
For sure. Yeah, I think just another thing, I don't know how we're doing on time, but yeah, something also just, I think off topic a little bit, but on topic of just like the squares I've seen, but that we haven't touched on yet, is just the, there was one that was like drunk consent isn't consent. And I think in this region, there's a lot of drug abuse, and it's very unfortunate, and that alone is worrisome, but also the drunk and then sexual assault abuse is pretty high too. And so just, yeah, that this, there's this idea that it was like, oh my gosh, it was crazy. You're still accountable for your actions, you know, even if you, like, there's still a DUI, like drinking and driving's wrong. Drinking and having sex, like assaulting someone, is still wrong. And I just think that that's an important thing to touch on too. But yeah, I think also you said something about, like, we're not there to solve it or make it better. But I do think TWC does, in a small way, make it slightly better. Not in like a...
Absolutely.
You don't investigate. But you are there to be somebody that says, like, I care for you. I'm here for you. And you can be safe here. And I think that that, in a way, does make it better.
A million percent. I think it's important to look at the history of legislation surrounding sexual assault is abysmal. You know, we have Denim Day because of some horrific court decision that invalidated survivors, and that our job as advocates, you know, we can work antithetically to the law if it is not serving the people who we're supporting, and that sometimes when we recognize that the legal system is in many ways perverse or overburdened or all of the above, that conviction is not something that is likely to happen. That's really difficult for a lot of survivors to hear. That's a horrible, horrible reality in which we find ourselves. It's really difficult to prove in court assault cases that involve drugs or alcohol. Like, that does not invalidate them. That does not mean that it is not assault to not give consent, even if alcohol or substances are involved. So we hear again and again at TWC that the most powerful tool we have is the ability for people to share their story, for them to speak out loud and be validated that what happened to them was wrong. There's so much power in expressing yourself and sharing your story and have someone believe you. And that's sort of like the biggest support that we can offer people, because we do recognize that the, you know, system we're entrenched within is not one that is supporting survivors of sexual assault, is not one that is prioritizing the conviction of people who perpetrate sexual violence. and helping people to understand that and to validate them and say, it is not you that this is invalidating. This is, you know, a long system that has this storied past of supporting the oppressor, because the United States is founded by oppressors that continues to oppress people, giving people space, giving people time, and unconditionally believing, accepting, and valuing that story is the biggest tool that we have. You're exactly right.
No, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So sort of the last thing before we replug all of the cool stuff we have going on in April, I've got a little graphic here for both Child Abuse Prevention Month and Sexual Assault Awareness Month about some myths versus reality. I think it's really helpful to, you know, be empowered with information. And here we talk about a lot of the myths, social stigma. So for both of these topics, I figured we could just spend a moment looking at some of the things we hear a lot, some of the myths that we hear, whether that's on TV, whether that's from our families, and sort of combating that with the truth. So I'll just kind of go ahead and read the one here for child abuse prevention, and then I'll pass it over and let Scotty talk to you about the sexual assault prevention. So regarding child abuse, we hear a lot that child abuse is usually committed by strangers. That is our myth. The reality is that most children are harmed by someone they know and trust, and that is often a family member or a close connection, like a babysitter or a caregiver in a different context. Another myth is that children will speak up if something is wrong. Children know what is uncomfortable or bad, and they'll tell you because they trust you because you're an adult. That is the myth. That is not our reality. The reality is that many children delay or never disclose abuse. And silence does not mean safety. That's why we talked about, you know, paying attention, knowing the signs. One of the big shifts that I've seen in advocacy work around child abuse, for a very long time, the idea has sort of been teach children what child abuse is so that they can get away from child abuse, which puts all of the onus on children. Even looking at our personal body safety sort of methodology, we teach people, children, the names of their body parts and what is and is not appropriate so that they can use our no-go tell rule, the say no, get out of the situation, and tell a trusted adult. The curriculum we are teaching to children puts them in the role of keeping their own safety. The big shift that is beginning to sort of happen is, hold on a second, while yes, that is very important, the main strategy for child abuse prevention should lie with the adults who should be keeping them safe. So empowering adults to know and understand the signs so that we don't have to rely on this myth that children will speak up. Big important thing. And then the last myth we'll sort of talk about is that child abuse happens in isolation. And that's not true at all. Violence in the home increases risk, and children exposed to interpersonal violence are significantly more vulnerable to child abuse. So like child abuse is the singular sort of issue occurring in a family, or the singular thing that is causing disruption or trouble in a child's life. That isn't true. You know, cycles of violence are complex, and they rely very heavily on generational experiences, systematic experiences. You know, if child abuse is happening in a home, oftentimes that's not the only kind of violence that's happening in a home, that these cycles of violence are pervasive in many other ways. So knowing that, you know, there's so much complexity, it's never a cut and dry situation that's easy to explain or understand, and being open and listening and validating those experiences is very, very important. So I'll shift over to Scotty, and we can combat some additional myths about sexual assault and what that looks
like. For sure. Yeah, I think a big common one also is this idea that it's a stranger that's going to do mm-hmm. the sexual assault. I was watching mm-hmm. Taken with my cat, and I was like, there's this like theory that it's going to be like this guy that's going to jump out in an alleyway and get you. But chances are it's going to be at a party, and it's your friend mm-hmm. or like your friend's friend who you don't really know, but you kind of know. And but it's like, it's not, it's someone you usually know. Mm-hmm. There's also this myth that it only happens to women. I think like that, I mean, that's one reason why I don't think it's been as successful, because dudes in policy are like, well, it's not happening to me.
Right.
And so I'm not going to do it. But it happens to 1 in 6 men. Yep. That's a lot of men.
And I think it's really intentional. You know, I think the myths, especially surrounding sexual violence, are really intentional. The mm-hmm. stranger in the bushes jumping out and assaulting people, or that, oh, this is a woman's problem. Those are really intentional myths mm-hmm. that then, again, put the onus on women to have to defend themselves instead of saying this is a deeply entrenched cultural value that allows women to assault, sorry, men to assault women. Saying it's a women's problem makes it not a policy objective. Saying, oh, it's strangers jumping out of the bushes allows us to say, well, let's crack down on crime instead of that, like, deeper held sort of understanding that in our society, men are more valuable than women. That disenfranchises men experiencing violence, and it disenfranchises women needing to be represented in our laws and in our power structures.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, I think that that's such a like a, I don't know, I can't, that's such an important issue. I was going to cuss, but I was like, I can't, I'm on the radio.
I keep on doing that too, because I get really fired up.
Like, but yeah, I think another one is that you can tell when someone is sexually assaulted. I think that's a big myth. It's really, it's not like an obvious, like you're not just like all of a sudden your hair's a different color, you know, like it's,
sure.
it's something like a little bit more silent, like mm-hmm. you were talking about. It, and especially just because there's already such shame around it too, mm-hmm. just the act in general. So like you don't want to admit that because maybe in your family, like you were told wait till marriage. Mm-hmm. And so then it's like your uncle does it to you and that's family. And so you're not going to say anything and you're just going to try and keep like living in silence. And mm-hmm. that's really tough. And you most likely can't tell. So it's really important to be a welcoming voice and like hear them out and be a safe place. Right. And then the last is, we already kind of touched on it, intoxication makes it less serious. That's not true mm-hmm. at all. But yeah, so those are kind of just the big myths that this graphic had that I felt like sharing.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that DUI analogy that you shared is really, mm-hmm. really, really important. Like that's some, like, drunk people make bad decisions. So it's a he said, she said. Like that's, it's so problematic. It's like, it's not a he said, she said. If one person is driving and one person is a passenger and they're both drunk, the person who is driving the car gets the, like we have that. Exactly. Like that's built into how the law works. We understand that intoxication is not a pass for behavior. And so it being so misrepresented in the context of sexual violence is frustrating, like very frustrating. I get fired up when yeah. we're talking about sexual assault prevention and awareness.
Well, it's just so,
so
alarming, too. Like, with, I don't know, we were talking about this last week, but just, like, mm-hmm. with the rise in, like, the manosphere
yes.
and just, like it feels like we were in high school. It felt like we were making progress. Glee mm-hmm. was coming out, and, like, everybody was, like, representation, like, women's voices matter. Mm-hmm. And now it's just, like, we are having leaders that are like, no, I'm going to hear out the dudes that don't have any respect for half of the world, like
yep.
52% of the world. And you're just like going to write them like that. It's just so it's so scary and unfortunate to see. And
well, yeah. and you really see I'd appreciated that conversation standing in the thrift store, support the thrift store with Scotty last week. It's like I brought some of the teens over to check out the thrift store. And it's like, how does that sort of new wave of sort of either like male apologists or like, you know, manosphere, negging women, like this idea that women's liberation from the 70s had really pushed back against, and we took back the night and we had slut walk and we like got some new understanding of it's not about what you're wearing. It's not like there was sort of this shift. And then we see that when institutions or people in power promote different messaging, we start to see over the last 10 years even sort of the trickling down of the highest held ideals and how that starts to shift how we tell jokes on TV again. It starts to shift whose voices are accepted versus not. You know, I feel like 10 or 15 years ago, there are things on certain podcasts that nobody would feel empowered to say out loud, that it would be shameful to hold that belief because it is so widely known to be wrong. Mm-hmm. And we really do see this cultural norm shift in a negative direction. And it just drives home so importantly how what we talk about matters, who's in power matters, like what we allow people to say matters, like just the pervasiveness of culture.
Yeah, and I think it's just like a select few have given a platform for it. Like, mm-hmm. I think especially just online, it's so worrisome. I'm off like every social media now except for Letterboxd, and that's like just movie reviews. Mm-hmm. but yeah, just like, I think it's just a feedback loop that mm-hmm. makes it seem amplified. And so you and your neighbors probably all don't believe in it, but then maybe you see 50 people online mm-hmm. and then you're like, well, maybe I could start believing it, because these people in this other area, instead of trusting your neighbors, you're trusting some people you'll never meet. But that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, I think it feels like we're receding on this. So I think another reason I'm happy to be doing this, like Denim Day Quilt, is to mm-hmm. be like, hey, it seems like we're maybe starting to make it more acceptable, and it's not. It mm-hmm. it never was and never will be. So yeah, and like this idea of community, like physical community, over just kind of like everybody needs like an online space community, like if you want, like I don't know that
it is the new normal. Yeah. Yeah,
but like physical community is really important too, and that's hopefully what that quilt symbolizes. It'll be mm-hmm. shown on April 29th, 6 p.m. in room 118. There's flyers around town too. Mm-hmm. Pizza will be there, and yeah, we'll have some people talking about it with more. I think maybe are there any TAV students? TAV students gonna be talking about it, or
I believe we have one or two young people who will be there to show their squares and to speak up about how sexual assault prevention is important.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yes, awesome events going on. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about a lot of topics, some really deep, important stuff, Scotty. You do great work at the thrift store, and this is such an excellent opportunity to sort of like marry the messaging, you know, mm-hmm. of community resources, physical resources, and these advocacy opportunities. I'm super, super jazzed to see how our quilt turns out. So that's going to be, again, April 24th. We're going to have the joint march from the Cultural Center to TWC for both Child Abuse Prevention Month and Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. That is going to be at noon. Please follow us on TWC's Facebook page for updates on that event. And then later in the week, we do on April 29th at the college at
Room 118, I believe.
What time again?
6 p.m.
6 p.m. So April 24th, April 29th. If you want to bring a square, if you want to share your thoughts, uplift someone else's voice, like please join us at both of these events. Being in community and using these opportunities to flex our say something muscles and to help prevent violence and help support those who have experienced violence is the best tool we have in our toolbox to reduce violence in our communities. Scotty, is there anything else you'd like to say before we sign off?
No, I can't think of any. Is there anything?
I'll just say, you know, we did talk about some really difficult topics today, and remember how important self-care is. For me, that's snuggling up with a cat. I've got four of them. I like to have them in my lap, and just like literally just having a soft, fuzzy thing to squeeze and feel close to makes me feel regulated and settled and happy. So my cats are my self-care. Find yours. Yeah. And remember that when we're talking about these hard subjects, that having an outlet and having something that makes you feel safe and supported is the only way we can help support other people too.
Cats are also a great way to learn consent and boundaries. My cat doesn't listen to me. I say no all the time. And she's always biting my leg. I'm like, hey, that's not nice. But luckily, we're all not cats. We're all humans. And we know no means no.
Absolutely. Uplift those consent messages, listen to your friends and neighbors, and join us on April 24th and 29th, and we will continue to help prevent violence in our communities. Thanks, Scotty. See you all next month.
Thank you for listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Listen online at kyuk.org, or tune in live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. right here on KYUK.